I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University. Hello, Martin.
Always good to be here, Michael.
Well, it's sort of timely for me to say I'm back from Adelaide and Melbourne, full of vigour, particularly after the Fremantle Dockers rolled Hawthorn in the last 11 minutes of the game at Optus Stadium last night, Martin. 5-1 in 11 minutes of real time to win the game. Did you see it by any chance?
I was there. I was at the Oval, and it was a superb victory by the Dockers. I think it was Worfy time they put up on the screen. Worfy time, and they just showed that it was and demolished the Hawks. It was a fabulous comeback.
Well, if there'd been a roof at the stadium, it would have been lifted by the crowd noise. Absolutely stupendous and really lovely. The Hawthorn fellow and family sitting in front of me turned to me after the match and shook my hand. I mean, this is unheard of in Australian rules in Perth, Martin.
Well, it's probably good that our footy fans don't quite behave like some of those what we would call soccer fans overseas, where they all burn the place down when their team loses.
Well, they sort of seem to be burning the place down in the UK in the council elections at the moment, Martin. There's very strange goings on. And I'm interested to ask you whether you think, with what's going on in Scotland, Wales, and council elections in particular, mayoral elections in England, that there's any sort of any signs for Australian politics.
I think there is. It could be considered a harbinger for what's happening here and what we can expect at elections coming up. So over in the UK, you've got a Labour government which seems to be pretty deeply unpopular for a whole variety of reasons, not least which appointing one of Epstein's mates as ambassador to the US, despite clear warnings that they shouldn't have. And then an opposition party that seems to be in a fairly messy place and unable to gain traction, which has really opened the door for reform. That's Nigel Farage's far-right party. And Liberal Democrats, which don't really have an exact equivalent of here. Maybe the Teals are closest, Michael. And the Scottish National Party. So look, there's a range of different parties there that are getting serious traction. And these local government elections, which are party-based. We don't sort of see that in Western Australia, but that's an opportunity for all those parties to test their support. And Labor's doing really poorly in results.
It's fascinating. On the Guardian website this morning, a piece written by Andrew Sparrow providing analysis of what's happening in these UK results. He says the results are set to have transformative impact on British politics. And the first point he makes, and he makes about seven, is that this is the full arrival of five-party politics in England. I mean, that sounds final, which sort of raises a question that I suppose we can't quite answer until we see the results in the Farrer by-election, Martin, whether we've got the full arrival of a number of parties in Australia now.
That's right. Well, this will be the test here. Of course, it's one small, tiny segment, but being in a regional area, it's going to test One Nation support in particular. I think it's less of a test for, say, the Greens or even Teals. I mean, there is a fairly environmentally friendly independent running who'll do pretty well, I suspect. But country independents are a little bit different from city independents.
Well, one of the challenges, I suppose, is that once you get out of places like Albury, when it comes to the Farrer by-election, into the true farming areas, the independent support seems to fall off, and regardless of attempts to find an Achilles heel in the One Nation candidate, they're not seeming to have much impact. What are the opinion polls saying today, one day in advance of the by-election?
Well, they're showing that One Nation has the highest primary in these opinion polls, followed by the Independent and then the Liberal and National parties. And I think if you look at what we might expect based on the how to vote cards and the like, probably Liberal and National voters are more likely to give One Nation preferences than the Independent. And so if One Nation's already leading on the primary, they're in a pretty strong position to pick up the seat as a whole. It's a very disparate seat, as you suggested, Michael. See, what Albury's probably the place where the Independent will do the best. And then it stretches west and north from that point, and it's got a number of smaller towns, a lot of irrigation country, Michael, where water's a huge issue, and I think that will probably help some of the Conservative parties who feel that too much water's been taken away from them for environmental reasons. That's the narrative, Michael, in a lot of those parts.
Grump, grump. I suppose in uncertain geopolitical times, or in a sense, in uncertain national times, people do become more conservative. They pull the drawbridges up. They want to keep people out. Do you think the return of these IS brides who've been in a refugee camp in Syria for some years is likely to filter into and affect the voting mind in Farah?
It's a really good question. I think it's probably it's not a huge issue right now, probably in the by-election, but it does feed into a broader narrative here, where there's a cost of living problems, there's economic anxiety, a lot of people are doing it tough, and yet this group of people that seem to have very little sympathy, Michael, on account of their past activities. Coming over here and being helped back to Australia and all of these things. So I think it's probably exacerbated by existing frictions. The government's doing everything it can to be seen to be not helping them, Michael, and that's charged a number of them with very serious offences, I must say. Slavery, nonetheless, terrorism, entering a restricted zone. I mean, these are very serious charges. I think the slavery ones alone, Michael, are 25 years each maximum. So a small number of these women anyway, they've come back here, but they're facing very serious charges.
Yes, well, I'm still getting my head around all of that, but the facts will become clearer as they pursue those charges. Martin, while all that's going on, of course, we wonder what else is going on in the Middle East, particularly with Iran. You keep telling me week to week not to listen to what Donald Trump, the President of the United States of America, says, but to look at what he does. Well, my head's spinning, Martin. You can't even look at what he's doing. He's doing this, he's doing that. He's just about to do peace, and now he's firing on Iranian-flagged ships. And the Iranians have fired back. Saudi Arabia's refused to let America use some bases there. I mean, the whole thing seems to be a complete mess so far as resolving the war's concerned. What's your latest mail? What are you thinking?
We keep getting told that a peace deal is imminent, and it may still be. They say the darkest hours before the dawn. So often there's fighting right up to a peace deal, and that fighting is often designed to try and influence the peace deal and to perhaps gain extra leverage. And that's actually not that surprising in a way. And I think that there's actually a desire from both sides probably to get out of this. But they need to get out of it on terms that make them look good. So, in particular, Trump, and Trump can't just get around opening up the straits. They've got to get some kind of commitment on nuclear weapons. I think that's the be minimum benchmark that Trump's after. Iran has to get some easing of sanctions out of this. So, I think that's at the heart of the deal, those two things. And of course, opening up the straits. But I think that's a bit of a given. I think the US wouldn't tolerate anything else. And it's not just the US, Michael. On that score, the international community wouldn't tolerate anything else other than that. You can't have all of global trade restricted like this. So that's at the heart of the deal. If they can get that part of the deal done, I think they might draw a line under this.
Well, Ryan must be rubbing their hands together with glee at the moment. I mean, the New York Times on an issue like this is probably the best place to go. The headline is Trump reversed the Hormuz plan after Saudis denied airspace access. And then it says Saudi Arabia's refusal to support suggests that President Trump's approach to Iran has strained ties with one of its closest allies in the Middle East. It does sound pretty serious, Martin.
I think that we've got to a stage where a number of these countries want to draw a line under this and make peace. And they would find the mixed messaging from Trump right quite frustrating. On the one hand, you're threatening them and doing some bombing. On the other hand, you're saying a deal's really close. Which is it? And I think that's drifting. They're probably getting some pushback inside their own countries too, around because these countries want global certainty. And they want they're economic entities, aren't they? They're pumping out oil, they're making a lot of money, but they can't do that at the moment.
Well, and there's also religion that enters into it. On which topic, I see a good Catholic, Marco Rubio, was off praying with the Pope in Rome the other day, Martin. What's that all about?
He says that there was a pre-scheduled trip. I think that's a load of tosh, quite frankly. It's a peace-seeking mission, because all of the bile and the vitriol have come from Trump towards the Pope. The Pope has said that he advocated for peace and spoken out against aggressive war, but he's always spoken about in fairly general terms. Whereas Trump has said the Pope's wants Iran to have nuclear weapons, Michael. He wants, he's weak on immigrants, he's weak on crime, he's weak on a lot of personal attacks on the Pope. And I think that's going down very poorly amongst US Catholics. And so I think the peace deal is sending Rubio over there to try and smooth things over.
I suspect Trump will be demanding that the Pope signs a non-proliferation treaty and give up all his nuclear arms before long, Martin.
Well, I'm not sure what they can expect of the Pope, because he's not the first or last Pope to speak out about peace. And there's no chance that he can silence the Pope in that respect. He has no jurisdiction, and I think that would backfire. So it's mostly around placating, I think, at this stage.
Well, there's an old saying tucked away somewhere, not just in the Christian Bible, Martin, but blessed are the peacemakers. Would have thought it's the number one job for the Pope. But anyway, leaving that aside, there's some peace being made by the WA government in its just handed down state budget with local residents. We're all, Martin, whether or not you've got an EV, so long as you hold a driver's license, you're going to get $100 paid into your bank account, surely, to do with it like you want. What do you reckon? That sounds to me a bit
Well,
crazy.
I'm never a big fan of the sugar hit stuff, Michael. I think they take this approach because they don't want a longer term impact on the budget, operationally. So it's throwing money in the short term measure. It's designed to be a cost of living measure, but I don't think it materially. Firstly, it's too small to make a massive difference to people, and then on the other hand, it's still a drain on budgets, and it could be spent better and more effectively. So I don't think it achieves either of those things. It might make people feel a little bit good, but it also probably plays into the sense that governments don't think long term enough.
Martin, I'm sure it's also designed to be the very first state budget matter discussed on View from the Roundhouse today, and in that, it has been successful, and no doubt in other media outlets, publications as well. But what were the eye-catching sort of positives and negatives in the state budget as you saw it?
Look, there's two ways to look at this fiscally. Structurally, as in an operational sense, the budget's in sound condition because it's about a $3.5 billion operational surplus. That's good. On the other hand, there is actually rising debt. So the debt's risen a fair bit from $34.5 billion to $40 billion. So that's for these longer term investments in infrastructure and other places. So that's something that the government's going to be really mind have to be mindful of as time goes on. They're saying it's going to flatten out, but I think they're the two counter-prevailing things in this budget that underpins it all. There's big investments in housing, education, and health, which you'd expect, and that's where most of the energy has gone. Even if we end up talking about the $100 sugar hit.
Martin, the money that's being thrown at the areas you talk about, housing, trying to solve homelessness, all of those sorts of things, are of course long-term fixes, aren't they? No one's going to see anything happen too quickly, which I think is the complaint of the lobbies that are trying to help affordable housing and homeless people and so on.
I think this is the dilemma that a government has. Actually, the longer term investments are necessary and they'll pay dividends. It's actually the right approach. But on the other hand, they don't see the benefit of these things in a hurry, and they don't help people right now. And that's why the $100 hit was, I think, was thrown around, right? It's the sugar hit. Because in housing, it's the longer term things over time that start making a difference. Mostly, there's a lot of energy going into WA on housing supply, and that's actually where the issue is. Probably the one part that's missing is Still trying to attract enough workers to make it happen. We're short on critical skills in Western Australia. So unless that follows, then we're still going to have all these blocks and obstacles.
All right, Martin. It's time, I think, to sort of act like the Dockers did last night in the last 11 minutes of the game, decisively kicked 5 goals and 1 point, reduced a 3-goal deficit, and won by I think 18 points. Just astonishing stuff. But they put their mind to the job. Now I'll give you the easy question first. I think it's the easy question. Who's going to win the Farah by-election tomorrow?
Oh, I think One Nation will win it. I'm pretty certain about that.
Second question is, do you think anyone really gives a, as they used to say colloquially down at the pub, a rat's so far as the WA state budget is concerned?
Look, it'll be a lot of hot air in and around Parliament. I suspect what we've got in a couple of weeks, very, very shortly, is the federal budget, Michael, and that's what's going to get all the energy, not the state budget.
And we've talked about the federal budget almost ad nauseam. We're all expecting big things in tax, in negative gearing, in some other areas. Are you predicting anything in particular at this point?
I think in line with what we've talked about largely to date, it's mostly going to be around reform in the housing area, tax reform in the housing area. I think they've probably walked away from export tax on gas. They are doing the gas reservation policy that WA has had in place for a long time, 20%, not 25% like we have here. But needless to say, that will be really welcome. That was a good announcement, I think. How do you get to a stage, Michael, where you're producing most of one of the largest gas producers in the world, but you have gas shortages? That's
Well,
just insane.
it's a funny thing. I was talking to a very knowledgeable and well-informed person over lunch in Melbourne earlier in the week, Martin, and he remarked on the WA reservation policy very admiringly. It's well done, Alan Carpenter, in the day, I suppose you say. Martin, Iran. People are travelling, students are going off to Barcelona and Lyon pursuing their studies. I get emails from people who just arrived in Sicily. And even when the UAE gets attacked by Iran, as it did the other day, and they close Dubai and everyone gets nervous, it seems that we're now just ignoring Iran. We're flying around them and we're getting on with life.
There is impacts though in Europe. I'm told a lot of people in Europe have stopped traveling, and they've cancelled a lot of flights, even internally within Europe. And we've got some visitors and partners that don't want to come here to Australia, and not that they don't want to, but anxious about coming here to Australia. So, well, I think there's still plenty of hidden economic implications of this, which will take a while to resolve, even if we get a peace deal.
Well, I just mentioned to those partners, Martin, that Fremantle Dockers are doing very well and they should get here quickly because the 8-stretch win, I think, is going to be stretched further.
Oh, well, I think they've got St Kilda coming up, and I reckon they can knock them off. Yeah, the sky's the limit at the moment.
Well, I think we've got Essendon too. We should look pretty good, shouldn't we?
Well, anything's possible.
So I wonder what they did talk about in the middle of the hottest part of the Second World War and the First World War back at home. Did they get on talking about the footy and celebrating Mother's Day, birthdays, all that sort of thing? I suppose life went on, Martin.
I'm certain they did, and that's one of the roles of sport and other forms of entertainment. It's a form of escapism and helps us feel good about ourselves amidst difficult times.
Martin, thanks very much for joining me today. All power to the peacemakers, and let's see where we stand with domestic politics, particularly when we get together next Friday.
Pleasure as always.
See ya.